succession number 9938, Reel 2.
Mr. Philpott, Reel 2.
And in Douglasstrasse 11, I find myself staying with the Seck family, S-E-C-K. They were ardent Nazis. They're pleasant people as people, but one got the full works of the glories, so-called, of the new regime. And even Herr Seck, who is an oldish man and not given to talking all that much, would listen to a Hitler raider, Hitler speech. And I would listen to this too in supper time in that villa among the woods of Grunewald. And Seck, at the end of it, I remember on one occasion, he just stood up and addressing his wife and myself and his daughter, that is his total audience, he said, when will the world march out against the Bolsheviks? And he'd just been told by Hitler that that's what he ought to do. One also saw, talking of aircraft again, the 9 p.m. Junkers tri-motor aeroplane going off to London each night. It came droning past. At the office of the Margarine Verkaufs Union, I studied the German rationing system. Whether the Germans quite understood that or not, I never discovered. But Vandenberg, who later became director of margarine for Great Britain and saw the central fat was distributed in a highly able, if not brilliant, manner, he had suggested it might be a good idea to see how the Germans rationed their fats. There was you could only do free sales of these sort of things of cheese, what they called Bauernkäse, ordinary peasant cheese, converted into Tilsiter and Emmentaler, and so on. The margarine supplies were carefully cooked, because that government, Hitler government, would do absolutely anything at any time. The whole rationing system was bastardized, and I remember seeing the figures for the margarine ration, because they were short of this fats, in East Prussia, for instance, cut drastically in order to drag in a whole lot of margarine, which is shown in all the shops, for the Olympic Games of 1936. And I went to these games from time to time, and I remember sitting there in this wonderful stadium. It's still, I'm told, a very good stadium. I was directly opposite, across a vast space, of course, directly opposite Hitler, Goering, and Goebbels. And I remember looking round and thinking, not that I think I would have joined them, but if any determined people wanted to have killed that lot of international crooks, which is what they were, you'd want about 60 people there, I think, in a whole screen around where I was sitting, and to smuggle in a jolly good machine gun or two, and you could have done it. But of course, what would have happened to anybody who tried that was unthinkable. Coming back to the games, I did see Jack Lovelock, the New Zealander, win the 5,000 meters there. A wonderful sight. We waited. We couldn't see him until the last bend. And suddenly, this light figure came steaming up the outside, overtook everybody, won the 5,000 meters at the Olympic Games in record time, and he kept on running. And he ran right round the circle at the end, dive down into the basement place where the changing rooms were and to collect his sweater, and then came up practically without stopping all the time, having won the 5,000 metres in record time. The opening of the Olympic Games had provided quite a diplomatic problem, which is much talked about before they started, as to what the British contingent should do. They'd march past the Führer, and they had their very, very smartly dressed and so on, and they did a very, very smart eyes right, but they did not give the Nazi salute. They seemed to get by with that. The funny thing was, the very nation which Hitler, once the war had started, chose to attack first, France, the French contingent got the biggest cheer of all. I've never been able to make out why that was, but Berlin at that time was a curious place. I visited, I went out on sales trips with the Margarine Verkaufs Union, and I visited a lot of bakers, because they had to have their margarine rations and so on, and that was part of the commercial operation. And I remember on a particular day, they all, some of them shook me by the hand and all came up to me and said they were horrified to hear that our King Edward the Eighth had been attacked by a man who had thrown a pistol which had hit his horse on a parade. And they said how glad they were that our king had been preserved. What an astonishing regime that was. They kept it all going by close control of foreign exchange. They only had £1.25 million. They numbered about 80,000 people under their control at that time of foreign exchange. And of course they had that brilliant man, had Dr. Schacht, very bright indeed.
Did you come away from Nazi Germany with the feeling that they were a threat to Britain?
Yes. Well, that's very well illustrated by November 36, when my father came over to have a look at all this, have a look at me and have a look at all this. And I remember it was a grey day, and it was the occasion when Joseph Goebbels, a revolting monkey-like little man, terrible man, as Gauleiter of Berlin, was celebrating his 10th anniversary. And he scrambled out of his car, and everybody did the salutes and so on. And then they got going with endless, I think this probably answers your question, endless green-gray ranks of highly drilled soldiers going along that vast Unter den Linden, goose-stepping away, one after another, crunching away as the November dusk fell. And I remember long after that, some time after that, back in England, hearing that our Foreign Secretary, Lord Halifax, is going to visit these people to try and get some sense in them, and optimistically, I suppose, goodwill. And he took his golf clubs to the Nazis. Yes. Then, of course, the crash of war actually came, everybody knows, 3 September 1939, and I'd put myself in a stupid position because I'd believed that Chamberlain, I don't know why quite, I can't imagine why now, could deal with the dictators. As we well remember, he certainly couldn't. And I wasn't a member of any official part of the RAF, and I chased around recruiting offices and clamoured to join, but it wasn't until January the 15th, 1940, that I was able to join the Royal Air Force Volunteer Reserve. And clad in uniform and so on, I went down to Hastings, and one was drilled on Hastings Pier, marching about in one's RAF uniform, for navigation lessons. They're certainly pretty worthwhile lessons to be given. And I remember Critchley of Greyhound fame was in the RAF there, and he was in charge of us and at that time. Then there came Hatfield, going up to Hatfield, where one went through the whole thing again. One did learnt on tiger moths now, and that very cold winter of January 1940 will always impress itself on my memory. Likewise, the compulsory learning of the Morse code, which I was never very good at, and be tapped out on these instruments, and the rest of the class be laughing at some funny thing that's put across in Morse code, and I couldn't follow. But I worked it up to a tolerable level in the end. I then went to Yatesbury, an advanced elementary training school in Wiltshire there, near where the famous Uffington horse is. Uffington horse, inscribed in the hillside there, goodness knows how many years back. And part of the drill was to go and do a picture of this. A, you had to find it, and B, you had to do a sketch of it. And if you didn't do a good sketch, you went back again to do a good one. The thing that never attracted me about flying was night flying, and I found my first night flying lessons, which were there at Yatesbury, absolutely awful. And at one stage, fortunately with my instructor, I was doing an approach to land with my eye on the flare path, and suddenly there was no flare path, and the instructor seized the controls and roared the machine up because we were actually below the level of the hill. Brize Norton Service Training School was next, and that still had, you'll laugh at this perhaps, that still had, when you went to make your number with the commanding officer there, little silver trays in which officers would leave their cards and so on, which is a touching thing of peacetime. We flew there, and now at last we've left biplanes behind, Airspeed Oxfords, which were two-engine aircraft, monoplanes. And we learned to handle two engines, which wasn't all that difficult, except on one occasion in a formation when we were doing a drill and changing places in a formation, when some clot of a pilot who was meant to drop back from my right-hand side and keep my tail in view instead thought he'd be clever and just drop below my level and came up just underneath me for some reason best known to himself and hit my tailplane. And the it's pretty unhealthy to have a run into another aircraft in flight. It's usually fairly fatal. And the thing juddered like blazes, and I peered over the side, wondered whether to go down by parachute, but I never thought I'd like to parachute, so I hung on, and it wasn't all that badly damaged, and I did a juddering landing back at Brize Norton. The instructors had something to say to the other chap pretty crudely. One of the fun there, one of the bits of fun there was low flying over trains. If you were told to practice low flying, it's rather fun waiting till a train came along and whizzing past the engine, and the engineers practically lowering their heads. During the Brydes-Norton period, we're now in 1940, there was, of course, an appalling thing. I can't stress how appalling it was, given out on the radio at lunchtime in that very nice mess, and we were there in some in considerable numbers, that France had laid down their arms. And this was absolutely shattering. The old man, as we called him, and we always listened to him, came on.
This is Churchill.
Mr. Churchill. England would fight on. She had not and would not alter her resolve. No terms. No surrender. And we just listened to this, and people mumbled, yes, yes, yes. And during the rest of the meal, nobody said anything at all. We were so shocked. And we went down to the flights and did our practices down there. And gradually, by tea time, we were chattering again. I came out fourth on the course there and got an above average rating. And that meant that you could take your choice for what you're going to do in flying in a squadron, in an operational squadron. There were flying boats, there were bombers, there were fighters. And they flatly refused to let me go for fighters, which I always wanted. And I didn't particularly want the other things, the flying boats, although the best pilots were recruited for them, and the second best, the bombers, and the third lot were fighters. And I said, well, what else is there? Because you had choices if you came out fourth. And they said, you can go for torpedo bomber. And so I did. I thought next best to a fighter. And when I came back to where I was in Diggs there that evening, my instructor, who had been having an off day, said, well, what did you go for? Expecting flying boats or something like that. And I said, torpedo bombers. And he just stopped and he said, you bloody fool. And I said, well, that's that. I signed the thing. And
why did he write like that?
Well, because torpedo bombers had a very bad reputation. They got shot down pretty often and were easy to shoot down from ships or from shore batteries and so on. I was allocated to 42 Squadron, which I attempted to join that autumn, according to orders, after leaving Edinburgh. And I had to go up to Wick, just south, what is it, 20 or 30 miles south or something, of John O'Groats, an extreme northeast of Britain, to Wick. And later the squadron actually moved to Lucas, which is near Edinburgh. I remember going up there on an endless train journey via Inverness, and one was to hear of these train journeys which went droning up Britain there, more or less endlessly after Inverness. Those trains would sometimes get lost Later on in the winter, in snowy conditions and so on, people say, well, where's the train? And it's very vague as to where it got to. It's lost in a snowdrift and so on. And if you were in Wick and moving about that town and you asked for something in a shop, they would assure you they'd sent south to the south for whatever it was you wanted, some item of stationery or something perhaps. And what they meant by that was as far south as Inverness. So one felt somewhat remote. I remember arriving there in the evening, and there were three black Beauforts came over the station and just taken off, and then they headed out over the North Sea. Wick Aerodrome was then a muddy mass, big aerodrome, fortunately flat, with no hills just around it. One doesn't want hills. And a glorious great muddy patch with various huts and the local school taken over, quite a large school, as the headquarters. I reported to Adjutant Samuel, Flight Lieutenant Samuel, in a hut there, which he was in the habit of getting to by a little grey Austin car he'd come buzzing in special petrol he got allocated. And I saluted him, although it wasn't really necessary, but he was in his office, so I gave him a salute. I said, well, where are the chaps? Where are the pilots and so on? So without a flicker of surprise, sitting there in Wick, in northeast Britain, said, oh, they're in Cornwall, he said. They've been there for some time. So I said, well, do I go down there? What are my orders? And he said, no, you just wait. And I went fishing there off the coast there and reported every day to say I was there and ready for battle, as it were, or more training for battle. One got fixed up for living in Mackay's Hotel there, the two redoubtable Mrs. M-I-S-S-E-S, Mackay. I think they were sisters, indomitable people. And they put us up there. And eventually I was put up in the manse, where the indomitable Reverend and Mrs. Dix of the Church of Scotland were the soul of helpfulness to stray pilots who might require accommodation. And they used to go up later on, it got cold, man mobile canteens themselves for the long-suffering ground crew there and so on. Staying at Mackay's Hotel, because really all of this, when you come to think of it, was a continuation of the 1418 war, continuation of it really. Was an admiral in full regalia who was really, I think, in charge of us all up north of Inverness. I think that was his remit. And sure enough, we knew that just as in 1418 the British fleet was in Scarpa Flow, and there it was. He was in charge of, and the RAF under him, of course, or along with him, however they aligned the responsibilities, in what is called 18 Group. We were members of 18 Group. And, of course, 18 Group is a vigorous NATO group now, which protects our shores now. So history continues. Wick had been bombed once there, and some civilians killed, which didn't appeal to the inhabitants of Wick very much. Don't blame them. And they saw a fair amount of Beauforts and various aircraft there and said, well, why did we allow this? Of course, we didn't happen to be fighters who could go up and tussle with bombers. Eventually, the squadron returned, 42 squadron returned from operations down in Cornwall, where they'd gone off to lay mines in estuaries in northwest France, and also they lost a few pilots, and I think more often they crashed on landing because the Beaufort. The Beaufort was an entirely different beast with which 42 Squadron had been brought up. They'd been brought up with wildebeest aircraft, biplanes carrying a torpedo each, and they'd been brought up with swordfish and so on, which were entirely different from large, in those days, large monoplane weighing 9.5 tons, and with the propensities, in our opinion, of a flying brick. And it took a lot of getting used to. The thing was, incidentally, useless with one engine, although the guidebook said the test pilots had had a fine time with one engine, it was all right. But they were up there with practically no petrol, no armament, no torpedoes, no nothing. And it was much later in prison camp that I came across five other Beaufort pilots who had in combat lost engines, and they just weren't any good in one engine. But the Beaufort is an interesting aircraft and encouraging in many ways, because except for this awful one engine business and so on, it had no flying vices at all. It didn't fall out of the sky if you did a flat turn or anything. It put up with the worst flying you can imagine, as long as you kept your speed up. And people used to run it into hills in a place called Chivna later in the war, with a lot of training, and I think they were training people too fast down there and too hurriedly, and it was really, I think, bad flying that caused Beaufort to get a poorish reputation, except for this one engine thing. There was a crew of four, which of course is very luxurious, because you had your navigator, and you had your wireless operator, and you had your air gunner. This is real luxury. And later on, of course, it was cut right down when the son of the Beaufort, the Beaufighter, came out, and that pilot and one other. In those days, you were meant to be a good navigator as well as a pilot. This is an RAF traditional, and it was still in being then. And so I was packed off to 269 Squadron, who flew American Hudson aircraft, and I did 6 operational trips with them. They were reconnaissance aircraft. They were little passenger liners, tiny little ones by our present standards, which had been dragged over from United States. Generosity of the United States made it easy. And they did endless patrols seeking U-boats all the time. And of course, one pilot whom I flew with, but not on this occasion, called Tommy Thompson, was the man who captured a U-boat from an aircraft which had unwisely come up. I think it had some depth-charging adventures somewhere off Cape Roth, and it couldn't submerge. And so he fired his machine, he dropped his bombs, and